Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Before the break, we heard from Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins on the recent police operations in the South End, a sweeping away of folks dealing with substance abuse disorders and homelessness. What do you think about it? What do you make of the sweep? What do you think of these kinds of approaches to homelessness and addiction in our community? Call us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we have a caller on the line, Lori from Jamaica Plain. Tell us what's on your mind.
Hi. Well, I had a personal experience of dealing with the homeless people in the neighborhood. I'm right at the Roxbury-Jamaica Plain line near Eggleston Square, and there's been an increase of homeless people in our neighborhood hanging out on that corner. And yesterday morning, I had the unfortunate surprise of finding out that someone had actually gone to the bathroom in my garden. And, you know, I had to clean that up. And then I started calling. Who do I call? I called 311. They said, there's nothing we can do. Call the police. I called the police. They pretty much said, well, you can talk to the community service director. You know, what can I do? He said, well, you can get motion detector lights. You can get surveillance cameras. You can build a fence. You know, I mean, these are all very expensive solutions.
So, Lori,
my point is, what you were just saying is, you know, where are the actual solutions at the end of the road? Like, I can call, but like you just said a minute ago, you know, do you serve the needs of the residents, the businesses, the homeless? What are the actual solutions at the end of those phone calls, you know, to actually help people and actually have solutions down the road?
Lori, that is the perfect question for our Week in Review panel. Lori, I'm sorry to speak over you, but now you've really set us up so well to turn to the panel. So I'm going to do that. Joining us now for our Friday Week in Review is Shira Center. She's the political editor at the Boston Globe. Shira, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
And also with us is Michael Jonas, executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Michael, great to see you.
Good to be here.
So Lori's asked a good starting question. Let's start there. You know, what's your response to her? And, you know, what do you think is the right next step in response to somebody like Lori's needs? Let's start with you, Shira.
Well, first of all, I think it's interesting that she mentioned she called the police, because this is what prompted a lot of the action in the South End. You had residents calling the police, and that's what in some cases prompted some of the arrests that have gone on. And that's really sort of imbalanced in terms of action, right? But you mentioned solutions in particular. There's no one solution to this at all. If there was, we would have already figured it out. No city in America, no part of America has figured out a solution yet to this problem, which is the problem in itself. I think it's especially interesting that we're talking about this at a time that overall the opioid-related deaths in the state of Massachusetts have decreased, but yet we see this major uptick, and I think it's a concentration in areas where a lot of people live. So it's just bubbling to the forefront right now.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Marlene is on the line from Lexington. Marlene, go ahead.
Hi. I'm just wondering why action wasn't taken on behalf of the people who actually are working in the shelters and trying to reach out on behalf of the homeless population that they serve before the corrections officer was hurt. In other words, this is a problem that was predicted by people who work with this population, and the encampment on Atkinson Street has been something that they've been observing, dealing with, and frightened by for a long time.
Marlene, thanks for sharing that perspective. I'm going to add one more. We're going to add Ted from Copley. Ted, go ahead.
Yes, I was a property owner in this neighborhood since 1980. And I can only say that what's happened is that the city and the state together have concentrated a population of homeless and drug-addicted people in this neighborhood for the last 15, 20 years. This is a problem that is caused by city and state government. I don't think they can clean it up, but I can tell you that the residents in this neighborhood, as well as the property owners and the employers and the people who work there, are severely impacted. I've had people fornicating in public in the parking lot. I clean out building lobbies every morning with people sleeping there. You can't run a business with this kind of activity going on. The restaurants are dying because to get inside a restaurant, you have to walk through a crowd of homeless people, panhandling.
Ted, just, thanks.
It's intolerable.
Thanks so much for that. Let's take it from there. I'm going to turn to Michael Jonas, executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Michael, this is a complicated issue. What are your reactions to these last two calls we just had?
I mean, I think they're expressing what you're hearing from a lot of the residents. And I think that, you know, D.A. Rollins was also speaking to those issues, but also talking about the concerns for the folks who are affected that are on the streets there. And I think, although she said there isn't or shouldn't be a tension between public health and public safety, I think there really is. And I think that's ultimately what this comes down to. I'm also struck that you sort of layer over that. Also, there are really issues of class. There's a lot of issues of race in this whole situation. And the Globe had a really gripping story today on the front page that focused on the South End, which is, you know, as people know, become a very affluent, gentrifying neighborhood, you know, increasingly white. On the other side of this corridor area, you know, are areas of Roxbury that are being heavily affected by this. I spoke earlier this week with State Representative Liz Miranda, who represents that area, and she really was pained by what's going on and really gave voice to the feelings of compassion that she has for the people affected there, but also this strong sense that the neighborhoods she represents are being burdened and disproportionately burdened by this. And although she was not happy or supportive, really, of the sweeps and the way they were done, she's glad to see some action taken. But frankly, she was, I think, a little disappointed or resentful that it took an assault on a corrections officer to finally get this sort of focused attention
point,
as opposed to the concerns. I mean, there have been kids at the Orchard Garden School who have been pricked by needles. They've been crying out for years over this.
Let's take one more call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Kathleen from Medford, go ahead.
Hi, how are you doing? So I'm calling in regards to just the name of this operation, Operation Clean Sweep, and how I find that to be so dehumanizing to the most vulnerable people in our community as they've put up more and more fences to get rid of the green space that forces people into tighter and tighter areas. And with the speed and precision and callousness in which these people without homes, all of their possessions were swept away, including medical needs, including wheelchairs, and how that was just done without a second thought, leaving all these people even more vulnerable without their necessities.
Kathleen, thanks for adding that perspective to the conversation. Shira, where does empathy, compassion, vulnerability fit into this conversation?
Right. Well, I think it certainly fits into the conversation. And there can never be enough empathy, right, for such a crisis as big as this. But if you talk to a lot of the residents in the South End, too, they're out of patience. I mean, it's very clear that this problem is not getting better. It's getting worse. So whatever we're doing, it's not fixing the problem or the increase is surpassed whatever efforts we're putting into it. So while there is room for empathy, and I think Boston actually compared to other cities has a very strong system for people who advocate on behalf of addicts, you need to make sure everyone is at the table for this kind of conversation.
So, Michael, you know, Commissioner Gross pushed back on the framing of the wheelchair as being sort of callously thrown away. He said, listen, there was human matter on it. There were needles on it. This is about public health and public safety. There was such a flashpoint with that wheelchair. I find myself thinking of it as symbolic of a number of intersections. How did you think about it when that piece of this story came forward?
I mean, the image of it is jarring, and I think the reaction of most people is sort of, I don't know, outrage or a feeling that this is overreach by the police. And that's certainly when this thing took off on social media, what the sense was. I know that the police pushed back on that. City Hall was originally saying that it was more complicated than that, which is what the commissioner is saying. At the same time, the city's chief of human services was at a meeting in the South End the other night, and he said that was a mistake and that shouldn't have happened. So I think this tension, again, between public health and public safety, frankly, is something that you're seeing reflected even in statements by by leading city officials.
So we're going to make a shift now into a conversation, another very challenging one, which is the aftermath of the mass shootings this past weekend in El Paso and Dayton. Listeners, you can call in about that at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Before we leave the South End, though, we had a lot of callers. So I just want to take a couple more, and we're going to give the callers the last words on that subject. Nancy from Route 95 in Maine. Oh, we lost her. So Michael from Dorchester, do we have Michael? No. So this is your...
Yeah, hi there.
There he is. Great. Go ahead, Michael.
So I work as a paramedic in Boston, and the population of people that they swept up, I guess as they're calling it, is exactly the population of people that I work with on a daily basis. This was just a colossal waste of time, because the problem is any paramedic or EMT that you talk to will tell you that they are constantly taking the same people over and over again, taking them and locking them up and not offering them any type of care. All that's going to happen is they're going to serve whatever time that they got, and they're going to end up exactly back where they were in the first place. So they're just refusing to acknowledge the fact that they have to invest in public mental health care. Just throwing them in jail, just, like I said, they're going to serve their time. They're going to end right back up on the street where I'm going to be picking the same people up on a first-name basis again and again. They have to accept the fact that they have to financially invest in actually
Michael, we're losing you, so you're cutting out on the line, but I want to thank you. You know, I think that's an important, that sense of cycle is an important way that we can think about ending that segment. I want to move into this question of how we heal and are we a nation of survivors after these most recent spate of mass shootings. There were 31 people killed, at least, in Dayton, Ohio, and El Paso, Texas. Here's Boston Police Commissioner William Gross on the question of guns.
You want an answer to how many guns there are? That has to come from D.C. You're going to have to make some tough decisions to ensure that there's unilateral gun laws that dictate background checks, a waiting period, mental health evaluation. Why should there be a rush to sell the gun in the same day? It's too easy to get a gun.
As we've talked to people this week, there seems to be two focal points on healing. Some people want to deal with the guns directly, and some people want to deal with the pain. Let's listen.
I'm lost for words right now. My family's lost for words, but I got to remain strong. People can just go and buy guns and walk right out and kill people in broad daylight, broad nighttime. You know what I'm saying? Like, this has got to stop.
He just turned 63. We had just celebrated his birthday. My mom and my daughter wouldn't be here if it wasn't for him and what he did.
I had to pretend I was dead. He was right next to me. He shot 8 more rounds. And all I could say is, God, please take care of my children. And please don't let him do anything to my daughter.
1-800-423-8255. Boston, we've had our own pain. What is the path forward in America? Michael, Shira, either of you, what are your thoughts this week? Go ahead, Michael.
Well, I mean, I really worry that we're numb to this. I mean, we hear the voices of people, I think, who've been touched by it or who are close to it. And I think when it hits those communities, it hits hard. I think the rest of us are in some way struggling for how do we react to something that happens 1,000 miles away while we know it could be here tomorrow. But until it is, I think we're sort of in this cycle where, you know, it's Dayton, it's El Paso, it was the festival in California, and it's, I think it's still both a little bit abstract for the people who it's not affecting directly, and frankly, it's just been happened. It's happened so much that we've become a little bit inured to it. So there's a vicious cycle with the occurrence of it, making it harder to marshal kind of public outrage and sort of a call to action, it feels.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Shira, there seems to be at least now some appetite for action, which Michael just referred to. For example, background checks, red flag laws. Here's President Trump this morning speaking to reporters on the White House lawn, standing under that familiar hum we know of the presidential helicopter.
We need intelligent background checks, okay? This isn't a question of NRA, Republican, or Democrat. I will tell you, I spoke to Mitch McConnell yesterday. He's totally on board. He said, I've been waiting for your call. He is totally on board.
Now, remember, the president actually expressed support for background checks after the Parkland shooting as well. But Shira, is something different? Can something like better background checks make it through Congress this time?
Maybe. I mean, hearing Trump's words right there, the key one there was intelligent background checks. So what does that mean? And also, President Trump has said this before and then has not backed it up with legislation. He's talked about some kind of exchange with an immigration policy. I mean, what a lot of people are calling for is they just want this law on the books. They don't want to trade it for a wall or something like that. So I think in terms of D.C., I personally don't think it's necessarily in the cards in any time in the next few months. But, I mean, maybe there is a tipping point for a lot of these politicians.
What do you think, Michael?
I mean, I think it seems like they may take some action. You know, it's very hard to know. I mean, Mitch McConnell has held up bills until now and been opposed to them. So the idea that Trump's saying he's very interested, he's ready to go, I think you have to take a wait-and-see attitude, take it with a grain of salt. I mean, there's also another element that I sort of hate to bring up, which is not to be sort of, you know, sort of casting it in such dark terms, but it's not clear that something like the background checks will make an enormous difference in the kinds of things that we've been seeing. It's not clear that that's kind of the key, you know, interdiction point in this whole chain of events that leads to these shootings. It's, you know, we don't know. A lot of these people who have committed these probably would have passed background checks. They didn't necessarily all have red flags, not to sort of throw in the term from another proposed reform, but there weren't necessarily red flags in their backgrounds or anything that would have prevented them from getting approved through a background check. So I think, I mean, it almost makes it even more depressing that it's such a tough climb to get to some measures that, you know, may have, you know, fairly be of limited help.
We're going to have to go to a break. Oh, Shira, go ahead.
Well, I would just add that even if Congress does take action, whatever they do, will it even be enough or even approach enough? Because the situation is so complicated, it's not a matter of just one solution. Let's say they get together and they pass a national red flag law, right? So there are about 6 or 7 or 8 different things you need to do to even get close to some of the gun laws you have in other countries with much lower gun violence rates.
Let's add 1 or 2 caller voices before we go to the break. Thomas from Brighton, go ahead. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, how are you guys today? The guy that was just speaking, he was saying how if you do background checks, maybe the guy would have passed the background check in regards to the red flag law. But that's also not necessarily true. And who's to say that they would go that extra length and wait? And maybe they might not be in the same mindset 2 months down the line or a month down the line, however long the background check takes, because it should take longer. And the other girl was completely correct in saying there are 7 or 8 problems. It's everybody's at fault. It's not the Republicans. It's not the Democrats. It's America. America has Donald Trump was the one who lit the match. Donald Trump can make a difference.
Thomas, I'm going to stop you there just because you've got a very choppy line. It's both Democrats, it's Republicans, it's America. That's a strong thought. Let's take one last call. Roger from Hingham, go ahead.
Hey, thanks a lot for taking my call, and I appreciate the conversation. It's really important. I have 2 quick ideas. Number one, the idea that this is an intractable problem is ridiculous. There's effective gun control legislation in Massachusetts that limits the number of there's an assault weapons ban. There's licensing. It's very difficult to get a personal carry. There's effective, sensible gun legislation in this country that works.
What's the second idea, Roger?
Shootings in Massachusetts. The second idea is this is caused by the Republicans who are in the pocket of the NRA, and you have to be honest about that. And people who say it's both sides is ridiculous. It's the NRA, and it's Republicans who take millions of dollars from the NRA to stop any level of gun control. And so your guests are talking about maybe we can get background checks.
Hey, Roger, sorry. We have to go to a break. I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're going to have to go to a break. Shira Center, political editor at the Boston Globe. Michael Jonas, executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine. And we want to invite you back to the table, too, 1-800-423-8255, for our next topic, which we are calling a transportation roundup. From the ongoing scandal at the RMV, where Attorney General Maura Healey told Channel 2 that the Baker administration bears the responsibility.
This is outrageous. It is just shameful what transpired at the registry. I mean, unacceptable. lack of leadership, lack of management, lack of accountability that apparently may have led to, may have contributed to serious and devastating harm.
And there's a new study from the Massachusetts Department of Transportation on something we all know pretty well. Traffic is at a tipping point. Here's Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollack.
The Commonwealth's economy is strong, population has been growing, jobs are being created, and dynamic and flourishing places draw a crowd. That is the first finding in this report. Congestion is bad because the economy is good.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What do you think is the heart of the story on transportation here in Boston? All right, Michael, Shira, what is the story here? Shira.
Well, I think there are a couple stories here. First, I'll just note that it's always interesting that politicians, when asked about the traffic congestion lately, like the first go-to talking point is, it's because the economy's great. I mean, never mind, wages aren't up that much, right? Okay. All right. Putting that aside for a second, I think the story here is that this is become an albatross around Baker's second term, right? Between what's going on at the RMV, the MBTA, the traffic woes overall, which, you know, is news on today's front page. But if you've been trying to commute into the city of Boston for the last 5 years, is not news to you at all. And these are serious issues, and they extend beyond the core constituencies of the city of Boston. They go into all these parts that politically are very important to Charlie Baker. So I think that is really key for him as he looks forward, because he has indicated some interest in running again, which is another reason why Maura Healey's comments are
exactly
so interesting.
Right. Well, so, Michael, let me just let you add.
Well, I think, I mean, just to jump on off of one of Shira's points about Baker's constituencies, I mean, one thing that I'm struck by is that in some ways in this whole discussion, the business community has sort of been more out front than the governor in wanting to see big things happen, including a willingness to see taxes, new fees, things that, you know, that they're usually averse to. And the governor has been more in the position of sort of tamping down some of that talk. But I think, you know, to the Secretary of Transportation's point about the economy being sort of, you know, roaring and being the cause of it, I think that the people, the captains of industry in the region, are the ones saying that that, you know, we need to do something or we're going to imperil the very thing that's sort of causing this in her estimation.
1-800-423-8255. Let's take a call. Barbara, you're calling us from Newburyport. What's the story on transportation?
The story on transportation is there are simply too many cars on the road, and trying to manage the cars better is a losing proposition. We need better public transportation. I take a train on a daily basis that's 30 years old. They're infrequent. They're poorly managed. If we had better transportation and better public transportation that actually got people somewhere quickly, there would be fewer cars on the road. And trying to manage cars, you can't build enough highways to accommodate them.
Barbara, thanks so much for that call. Marjorie from Framingham, go ahead. What's on your mind?
All of the congestion and the traffic is all due to poor city planning. And who's in charge of that? They can only blame themselves. They can't blame the regular people just trying to get to work or to school.
Thanks, Marjorie. So Marjorie brings up an interesting point, Shira. We've talked about how clearly transportation is an issue that's kind of hanging around the neck of Charlie Baker in his second term. But this is decades in the making. So one, where else is there blame to be placed? Two, does it matter where the previous blame is? And three, what do we actually do, especially to the point of getting more actual rapid transit in place? You could just answer all those things.
All
for
of those,
us,
right. In the next 30 seconds,
that's
no problem.
Just jump on.
So I think you're right that it is a long term problem, right? This is something where the investments, and Charlie Baker is very quick to mention this, that the investments were not made prior to his administration. So it is a long term issue, but I think it's really coming to a head right now because there are so many more people moving into the city. Right. So I think that's part of it. In terms of city planning, you know, this is one of the oldest cities. We have one of the first transportation systems in
cow
the country.
Paths.
Exactly. Cow paths. So I think it's hard to blame that kind of city planning, but in terms, there are other things you can do with city planning in terms of where you build affordable housing or where you build housing in general that can affect these kinds of commute patterns, in terms especially of building outside of the outer ring of Boston and creating transportation systems that are effective and reliable that go there.
So, Michael, this also makes me think of what Rachel Rollins was saying at the beginning of the show, where she talked about this is a Commonwealth level issue. Now, it was on a different subject, but we have become so interdependent in our transportation, and the report really talks about entire swaths of the eastern half of the Commonwealth, at least. So how do we develop integrated strategies around mass transit, congestion, you know, congestion pricing or high-speed lane pricing? How do we develop collective will that's going to get us where we need to go in the time frame we need to do it?
I mean, that's a good question. We'll see if we can do it. I mean, I do think the question about auto traffic and transit are just totally interconnected, and the state of the T questions about the commuter rail service are really closely related to the problems. I mean, you hear of people enduring, you know, hours long commutes in their cars, not because it's so great, but because they think the alternative is perhaps even worse. or even less reliable. So I do think, I mean, there's concern, I think, about the report on congestion that came out that the governor, is sort of inclined to sort of play small ball. He's an incrementalist. He's not one that sort of goes for, he's a big football fan. He doesn't go for the long bomb that often. And I mean, he did talk in this report about this idea of managed lanes, this idea of creating lanes that would be kind of a premium service lane that you would pay for. That is an interesting idea. That's maybe the one biggest play in there. But otherwise, he and Stephanie Pollack, I think the best metaphor would be that, like, if our problems with transportation and getting around are sort of the death of a thousand cuts or the result of a lot of different things, their approach is kind of a lot of small steps to try to patch together a solution to it. And there's some logic to it, but I think that there's also, again, some feeling that they need to sort of think bigger on it. I was struck that even the business group A Better City, one of the reaction from Rick Domino, the head of that, was that he wants to hear more about the role of transit in this.
All right, let's take a couple of calls. Dave from Taunton, go ahead.
Hey, you know, imagine if we had gotten the Olympics. We'd be right now in the middle of fixing the T. That's what would have happened. But we decided we didn't want to do it, so nothing's getting fixed.
So, Dave, you couldn't see it, but both the panelists smiled and kind of chuckled. So let me turn to either of them. Dave clearly struck a chord with the two of you. Would the Olympics have made a difference?
I think that's nonsense, frankly. I mean, we've been on an aggressive move with the T. I mean, at least since the great snowpocalypse meltdown of the T, the appointment of a control board, this sort of sudden focus that we need billions of dollars of capital spending to bring it up to snuff. The problem has been, you know, this challenge of figuring out a way to spend the money, the capital money, fast enough. So I'm not really sure what that would have done other than been this kind of sword hanging over our necks of 2024 that might have sort of set the planning and the expenditures off in a direction that wouldn't really necessarily be the ones we need for the long term, but we'd have this kind of short 2 or 3 week event happening just down the, you know, around the corner that everything would be focused on. So I beg to differ.
Okay, let me take one call and then I'm going to come to you, Shira. Alex from Hamilton, go ahead. Alex, you're on the line. Hi.
I'd just like to weigh in on this whole debacle as from the perspective of a student, in that I'm coming from the North Shore where the commuter rail is very impractical. It's infrequent, unreliable, and it's quite pricey for a college student. And then not to mention just trying to drive in at any more practical hour during the day is an absolute mess, and it dissuades me from wanting to work in or around Boston in the future.
Wow, Alex, that is such an important point, and straight to what the Master Department of Transportation report was saying. So, Shira, we're going to do hubbubs in a minute, but let me give you kind of last words on this in reaction to those calls or whatever else is on your mind about it.
Yeah, so what I think is interesting about what we've learned about what went on at the RMV and also at the derailment, derailments, plural, at the on the MBTA lines, is it's taken a lot of the heat off of Keolis and the commuter rail, which until until recently was one of the biggest complaints by commuters. And the caller is right. It is expensive. It doesn't run very frequently. At the same time, when Baker released his report yesterday, some of the biggest bottlenecks were on the North Shore, where this guy is coming from. So I think it's important to keep in mind as we focus on these other issues that it's really more than that.
Good. All right. Now, let's end with our hubbubs. We could all use some enjoyable brief stories or events that caught our attention this week but may not have been celebrated in the big time news. Michael, what's your hubbub?
Well, I think I'm gonna try to give us a little moment of uplift here. And so we all know that even day-old bread loses its allure. Bakeries often sell it at half price. So the buzz this week in bread world, at least, was about a loaf that was more than 4,000 years old.
Oh, my God.
And lusciously tasty despite that. The bread itself wasn't that old, but its key ingredient evidently was. So a fellow named Seamus Blackley, who's a video game designer and amateur Egyptologist, got access to an extremely stale but still intact loaf of bread in the collection of antiquities at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts. He was able to draw tiny bits of dormant yeast spores from it, wake up the yeast.
Holy cow. After a week
of cultivating the starter, he used it to bake a loaf of bread he describes on Twitter as having a crumb that is light and airy. The one caveat is there's testing underway now to determine whether he actually was able to revive a 4,500-year-old yeast spores or he simply grabbed ambient spores in the air. There's a scientist working with him to determine that. The scientist is betting that these really were from the 4,000-year-old bread. So I think, you know, as humans, we're always fascinated by things that connect us to the past.
Awesome.
I'd say this story takes the cake.
There you go. Shira, go ahead.
I have two questions. First, how does one become an amateur Egyptologist? Number two, did he try the bread?
He did. He said it was luscious
and Shira, light and airy. Rapid fire here.
Okay. So I'm just going to make a note of a Washington Post report from earlier this week that Seth Moulton, the congressman from the North Shore, Salem, was laying off half his staff, suggesting this could be the beginning of the end for his campaign. Now, Moulton's campaign spokesman has told the Globe that there was some restructuring. It was not quite half. But as we keep a lot of our attention on other candidates running for president for Massachusetts, namely Elizabeth Warren, it's always interesting to check on and see what's going on with his race, too.
Excellent. All right. And I'm just going to add that the Chinese Consolidated Benevolent Association of New England is holding the 50th annual August Moon Festival in Chinatown on Sunday, where they celebrate the harvest. There's culture, calligraphy, dancing, art, and music. I'm going to be out of town, but if I weren't, I think I would go. It really sounds like a magnificent cultural opportunity and probably one that a lot of Bostonians hadn't heard of and might not have done before. Michael Jonas, Executive Editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Thanks for being in.
Thank you.
Shira Center, political editor at the Boston Globe. Thanks for coming in, Shira.
Thank you.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I am Tisiana Deering, and I hope that you will join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.